Looks like you've been missing a lot of work lately.
I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
Live from the basement, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Hey everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and today's roundtable day, and you know what that means, more craziness. On today's all-special guest edition of the show, from the hit podcast Money for the Rest of Us, David Stein. And from the also-hit podcast Retirement Answer Man, welcome, shocker, the Retirement Answer Man himself, Roger Whitney. And of course, because what guest roundtable would be complete without her, from your richest life planning, please welcome Katie Brewer. And that's not all. In our FinTech segment, we talk to the 2016 FinCon FinTech Competition winner from CavOut, the head of business development, Cindy Zhu. And here he is, the guy tasked to bring this together into one amazing show, Joe Saul Sehy.
The bar is high, and hopefully we'll find a way to reach it. Hey, everybody, I am Joe Saul Sehy, Average Joe Money on Twitter, and what a great show we have for you today. But you know what? Before we get to the show, I got to tell you something fantastic. You can save $450 on average if you head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. Isn't that great? Who wouldn't want to save a bunch of money? When you go there, here's what you find. You find that that debt strategy you're putting together, you can get much lower interest rates if you compare more products. So in other words, why would you go to just one bank and ask them, what have you got? And they give you an interest rate. When you go to Magnify Money, a recent Reddit user showed that they look at 92% of all the products out there, which their closest competitor, they look at just over 60% of the products. So whether you're putting your debt strategy together, looking at your checking account, your savings account, and soon to come your mortgages, head to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. And guess what? For those of you with student loan debt, or while you're doing that comparison shopping, what you'll notice at Magnify Money, SoFi in the area of student loans and personal loans always seems to come out on top. And you know why? Because there's many different terms that are flexible. There are also interest rates that get better and better the higher your credit is. And you're able to work with them with very little fine print. You know very quickly, Dan Macklin tells us exactly what the terms will be. All you got to do to shop SoFi is to head to stackybenjamins.com/SOFI. And when you go there, by the way, for personal loans or for student loans, they're going to give you $100 as a thank you for going their way. By the way, they also do mortgages too. They just don't give you the $100 for the mortgage. All right, that's great stuff. But you know what? Even better than that, we've got an action-packed show today with a great crew, some fantastic articles. For those of you new to the Friday show, a little different than Monday, Wednesday, we have a list of articles from the popular press, and today's kind of think deep day, which you'll see. All right, let's get this show rolling. Let's walk across the basement to my dad's shortwave, see if we can fire this baby up and get some of the greatest minds this week in both writing, advising, and podcasting. Man, do we got all three boxes checked on this show. And let's start north and west, where a gentleman who operates one of my favorite podcasts, Money for the Rest of Us, joins us. David Stein, I believe, is here. David, you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me again.
I'm so happy that you decided to come back because the property value here in the basement is now higher.
Good to hear.
Yes. And how's the show going?
Show's going great. You know, audience keeps growing. Good feedback from listeners. Keep capturing interesting topics. So it's as you know, podcasting is an absolute blast.
It is totally. It's the most fun thing I could ever do. I was telling somebody that today. I think I found my calling because sitting in front of a microphone and talking, you know, that's.
Well, I hope so. After 4 years or 400 episodes, you know, by then, if you didn't like it, you would have stopped.
Yeah. Either that or I'm a glutton for punishment, David.
The pay is so low that, right. If you didn't like it, you would have stopped.
And let's talk to another podcaster today in Fort Worth, Texas. It's the Retirement Answer Man, Roger Whitney.
Hey-o, how you doing, man?
What's happening, dude? How is the Retirement Answer Man podcast?
Oh, we're just having a blast. I mean, it's crazy how many great ideas my listeners have of things to talk about. It makes it so easy.
Yeah, just when you think that you might be out of ideas, somebody sends you another letter that makes you go, oh, we haven't covered that.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about a few things today that are sort of in that line. It's like, wow, I didn't think of it from that angle. Why didn't we try that? It's amazing. Crowdsourcing creativity when it comes to that second half of life is pretty cool. I'm amazed. I'm really impressed with how creative people are.
Well, guess what? We got somebody on this podcast who knows how to cover every angle. Back for more punishment. It's the woman who operates Your Richest Life Planning, certified financial planner, Katie Brewer joins us again. Welcome back.
Hello. I feel like I need to have a podcast right now. I'm feeling a little bit out of the loop here. Jeez.
But I was going to say, why do you need a podcast, Katie, when I feel like you're on ours every third week?
You know what? That's what I figure, that I'll just, you know, go on Joe's and make a big wreck out of it. And then he can edit it all up and, you know, make me sound good-ish.
Yeah, we'll fix it all in post, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, sure. Well, we got three fun topics, and these are topics we haven't talked about much on the show. So I'm very interested in hearing what the three of you think about these. Let's start off with Inc.com and a piece by Minda Zetlin. Minda writes, survey shows most Americans believe big banks will disappear, and then in parentheses, and they'll be happy to see them go. David, would you be happy to see your big bank go bye-bye?
None. Well, maybe. My big bank is Wells Fargo, who I think we're going to talk about a little bit, for my corporate account. But the reality is that they're not going anywhere. The four big retail banks in the U.S. collectively have 45% of all customer deposits. So about $4.6 trillion. They, you know, as much as clients dislike them, they still put all their money with the big banks. And the reality is the big banks are the ones that are too big to fail. And so if you're looking for the safest bank, sometimes going with the biggest, is it might be a smart move.
Well, that's what they said about Lehman Brothers, I believe. Too big to fail. Well, yeah, just wanted to point that out.
The entire financial world almost collapsed. And what did they learn from that is don't let big banks fail. It won't happen again. Believe me.
Roger, do you think that David's right? Or do you think we just fall for advertising? Because man, those Bank of America ads and Wells Fargo ads, I mean, the advertising budgets of these big banks are huge.
Well, I think a lot of it is just simply inertia, right? They already have the money. So it's easy to keep the money. I abandoned my big bank, Bank of America, about 6-7 years ago. And I think for the normal consumer, there isn't a big need for big banks in terms of our day-to-day lives. I mean, credit unions, community banks serve 99% of what we need. Now, if you're a business and you have those kind of relationships, but I don't think they're a big issue for the individual. I don't think there's a need for them. They're too big now. They're serving people that are well beyond, you know, most people like you and I.
Yeah.
So I hope you didn't want Bank of America to sponsor this podcast. Roger just ruined that for you right now.
I didn't say it, Bank of America. He did.
I did.
I didn't say that. Roger, thanks for joining us. We'll see you some other time.
Click.
But there is a list of alternatives here to big banks. And let's talk about those for a second. Katie, she mentions credit unions here. Do you use a credit union?
You know, I have used credit unions in the past. I don't use it as my main bank, but I've always found them a really great place to look for loans. So car loans, mortgage loans, especially if I have any clients that are doing the whole thing where they take out two loans against my advice, but do it anyways. So I always find credit unions are a really a good place to look for, you know, any kind of lending money.
Roger, the next one on here is community banks. And a lot of people I know, especially around here, I bank at a community bank because I like going into this place like Cheers, where everybody knows my name. Do you use a community bank?
I actually use a credit union mainly just because they're close to me.
Okay.
But a community bank is a similar structure in that it's just a smaller, although it's not owned by the members, it's that personal connection where they're not involved in all the crazy things that all the major banks are involved in.
What about, David, these internet-only financial institutions? I mean, it seems like when you get rid of the brick and mortar, you know, Roger right now goes to a bank because it's close to him. I don't know when the last time is I went into my bank.
For my personal banking, I've used internet-only bank for over a decade. You know, right now I'm with Schwab, and it's great because they basically reimburse all your ATM fees. And since most people don't have cash anymore, there's no, and with the app to deposit checks, you don't need to go into a brick and mortar building. Now, I also invested in Internet Bank, or had my money with Internet Bank. The first bank that failed in the financial crisis was a bank called NetBank. I was a customer. And really, I had no idea they failed. All I knew is suddenly ING owned them, but it turned out they were the first one to fail. So when you're looking for Internet Bank, look for those that are on the larger sides.
But I think there's a lesson there too, David, which is when people get really worried about banks failing and the way the system works, I think it's kind of like your situation where people rarely even know.
Well, you're right. And this was my business. I didn't know. I just learned about it like a year later and realized, oh, they were on the failed bank list. And they just sort of get a letter and say, yeah, we merged and ING has taken over our account. And at that point, I joined Schwab
as my bank. That's the big key. They do that. They just, when someone fails, they don't just go away. They get gobbled up. Or I've had instances with CDs where FDIC stepped in and actually was very efficient in refunding the money very quickly with the interest.
Oh, wow.
That part of the system really does work well.
That's funny because I've had both older and younger clients that have said, I know it's in my best interest to go with an internet-only bank, but it scares me that I wouldn't be able to go in if I needed something, which is weird because it's like, well, when is the last time you went in? And they're like, I can't even remember. It's been more than 5 years. But for some reason, there's kind of that safety debt of you can actually walk into a bank if you needed to.
Do you think that's another allure, Katie, of the big banks?
It might be. But, just somebody was saying earlier, I think maybe Roger was, that once you open an account there, it just makes it easier to open up another account. Since he already poo-pooed all over BOA, my husband and I had almost an arm wrestling match over whether we were going to go with the credit union that I used or with Bank of America whenever we got married. And he won that battle. And I don't love them, but it was funny because I opened up my business checking just because I already had a personal checking. So I am actually one of those people who totally does that and goes with the bank that you don't really like just because it's convenient. You already have accounts there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think people eat at McDonald's because it's their favorite food.
They don't?
Oatmeal's not bad.
What'd you say? The Happy Meal, David?
The oatmeal's not bad.
I thought you said the Happy Meal. I'm like, I could see David Stein
in the corner
with the toy. Right.
Now, speaking from the mom perspective, that's where all of the bad moms take their kids so that they can just, play on their phones for 3 hours while they're in the indoor playground.
Yeah, while the kid gets in that gross thing with all those balls where you have no idea what's
no
in there.
No germs in there. No germs in there.
Hot tips from bad moms.
Yeah, I used to work at Chuck E. Cheese. And I remember having to clean out the ball crawl because some little kid would pee in there.
Oh,
man.
Holy.
Doesn't that make you glad to be where you are today?
Oh, yes. I've elevated so much from that humble beginning.
What about this idea? You were talking earlier, David, about using an online broker. What about just having all your money at the online brokerage account and maybe having an FDIC-insured checking account hooked up to your brokerage account?
Well, that's what I have. That's what my sons have. My sons have no money, and they have accounts. They're not sure what a brokerage account is, but they have a bank account hooked to their brokerage account. And it all comes down to, for most people, it comes down to fees. And online brokers have probably the lowest fees when it comes to banking. The interest, well, nobody pays very good interest at this point, but they tend to pay, someday when banks again pay a decent rate of interest, the online broker banks tend to pay more because their bank side is a loss leader. They're trying to get people into the brokerage side. And so they provide banking essentially for free. In fact, I make money in my bank because they're always reimbursing me for ATM fees.
I think it's funny, this idea, though, of banks paying a good interest rate. It seems like you have to be a person of a certain age. It's like, sit on Grandpa Roger's lap so he could tell you the story about when you got 4% on your money market account. Right, Roger?
And a toaster.
I can remember 6.5. I can remember being a young advisor saying, hey, you could open up an account here. We have the highest yielding money market in the country. It was like 6.5%.
Yeah. And Katie, you're right. The days when you got a toaster or a stadium blanket for opening the account. How great was that?
I hear all about those days. I'm sure they were fabulous.
Let's move on to our next article, which is on a little bit different topic. This comes to us from Fox Business. It's written by John Maxfield. Former Wells Fargo CEO John Stump could be in serious trouble. It turns out, Roger, that people might not like what went down at Wells Fargo recently. Say that's not true.
Well, I think this goes to the heart of the last topic we talked about is, at least for me, is these huge institutions do not serve the customers. They become an entity of themselves and they serve the shareholders, And the kind of incentives that you put into place can have these crazy effects like we saw with Wells Fargo.
And it's funny because what they're saying, and not funny, haha, but they're saying that it's been 8 years, Katie, that he received emails and letters from whistleblowers, according to this article, right? I don't know if that's true or not. So that's according to this article. But this article says, in short, it seems far-fetched to think that Stump won't, at the very least, be indicted for lying to Congress. You know, in the past several years, we've seen very few executives go to jail. It seems like the Department of Justice has been more interested in doling out fines than in sending people to jail. Do you think that stuff needs to change? Do we need to be more bigger activists in who's running the companies that we're investing in?
Well, it kind of depends on what perspective you're coming from. If you're coming from, you know, random citizen and what should hypothetically happen, yeah, absolutely. You want for CEOs to face the music and pay for what they allowed the organization to do and what they allowed to happen. If you are a shareholder of Wells Fargo, however, you are probably cringing every time that more news comes out about what happened because you're seeing your stock maybe fluctuate according to things that are completely out of the control of yourself as a stockholder. And essentially, you know, it's kind of in the hands of the PR companies at this point.
But if somebody, David, like John Stump goes to jail, don't you think that that in a taking a little bit longer term view is better for Wells Fargo? Because Wells Fargo can say, well, we're rid of that guy and now we're a clean company again.
Yeah, but he would go to jail because he lied to Congress. He's not going to jail because they opened up checking accounts. I mean, that's an incentive problem in terms of their employees, because they're very, very focused on meeting those quarterly numbers. And that's just the problem with Wall Street in general. I know a regional manager at Wells Fargo, and he talked about what a stressful environment. They weren't even having Christmas parties anymore so they could save money to meet the earnings target. And so it starts from the bottom up, just this demand. And so, and that's the nature of Wall Street. And I don't think Wells Fargo is the only one inflicted with that by any means. So yeah, if somebody lies to Congress, they should go to jail. But they needed to fix the incentives. There was incentive to open up the accounts. That was the problem. They needed we need better incentives for both employees and CEOs whose compensation is tied to meeting a quarterly earnings estimate.
Assuming, Roger, that you agree with David, do you think that job is Congress's job? Should there be closer laws, checks and balances? Is that a shareholder's job? Whose job do you think it is to keep these companies in check so that customers don't end up getting taken for a ride?
Well, ultimately, it's the culture of the firm and the board's job. You know, shareholders are looking out for their best interest. And I think it's just an issue of all the way the compensation is structured. And David talked about it. When you're a public company, you serve such an odd master in serving the analysts and serving the shareholders. And you end up losing the customer in that, and it creates the wrong kind of incentives for everyone. So if you're a CEO there and you have stock options and you have all of your compensation based on performance, well, you're going to go hell or high water to get that performance taken care of. And a lot of times you get results like this. Even if you are aware of it, like he may have been through emails, you know what? That's the cost of doing business. And if they get caught, then they pay the fines and they move on their merry way, which is sort of the structure we got now, which is just crazy.
But if I'm a shareholder, Roger, should I be writing in and you know, saying that there needs to be more changes at the top?
I think the common shareholder, and David may know more about this than I do, is they don't really have much say of anything because they're such a small shareholder. It's really getting boards that are actually doing their job rather than being more of a rubber stamping type of mechanism that I see now in a lot of companies.
Yeah. And you only see that if you see like Bill Ackman's of the world or the corporate raiders that buy enough shares to get enough influence to get their own independent board members. That's the only time we've seen changes in companies. Individual shareholders going to the meeting or writing in letters, it's a useless activity.
You know, Katie, it's funny with more and more people getting into index funds, which I know is something from your past appearances on the show you're a big fan of. It seems like that makes a culture where it's easier for companies to get away with stuff because what little voting power we do have now, we don't even know what we own.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in an index, I guess the good of it is that you've got such a wide variety, hopefully, within your index that, you know, Wells Fargo, if they completely went out of business, hopefully would not make your S&P 500 index go completely sour if that hypothetically happened. But, you know, you could say that you would know what's going on, but obviously this went on for many, many, many years without anybody really knowing about it in the public eye. So I'm not sure that as a shareholder of Wells Fargo that you would have known any faster unless you were actually working at Wells Fargo.
Almost like there were very few people at the top of Enron who had any clue what was going on there.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I thought it was fascinating that the author, you know, fairly negative article in Wells Fargo, the author owns shares in Wells Fargo, and Motley Fool owns and recommends Wells Fargo, and Motley Fool is where the article was. So
I know that was kind of a funny little, you know, disclaimer at the bottom where they're like, we own Wells Fargo. And you're like, oh, okay.
Well, maybe they want it cleaned up, you know, maybe this is press to help clean stuff up. I don't know. David, who ends up being the change agent here, or is there a change agent? Or are we just going to see this story repeat itself through Wall Street again and again and again?
Yeah, I don't think there's a change agent. I just think Wall Street by its nature is short-term oriented. I mean, sometimes you'll get hedge funds that can take an activist role. But I think you point out that with more and more investors indexing, you know, companies, they're just not long-term oriented. Very few are long-term oriented. They're all short-term oriented, which is why, you know, the benefit of a private company, your private company, you don't have to focus quarter to quarter. You can make some long-term investments.
I think there is no change agent is a very positive place to leave that article. We're all screwed. Got to take a quick time out from this awesome discussion with Roger, David, and Katie to say a big thanks to everybody who's gone to stackybenjamins.com/magnify money. And why am I thanking you? You should be thanking me for bringing Magnify Money to the table, because really that's our job, isn't it? It's my job to know that there are lots of different places that you can go when you're trying to look for better interest rates on your savings account, look for a checking account that gets rid of a lot of those baloney fees, and look for a place that compares more options when you're trying to get that debt strategy to a lower interest rate and better terms. StackyBenjamins.com/magnify money. You'll thank me when you go there, because the average person saves about $450 when they head to Magnify Money. Let's put another $100 on the table. While you're shopping, head to StackyBenjamins.com/SoFi. That's spelled S-O-F-I. Recently on the show, Nick at Magnify Money, you heard if you listened to our big FinCon episode, Nick was on and talked about how much they love SoFi. And that's for a good reason, because less paperwork, less hassle. Very quickly, you know what your interest rate is, how you'll work with them. And you know what? You get those student loans taken care of. You get your debt in line. StackyBenjamins.com/SOFI for student loans, personal loans, and now even mortgages over there too. You get $100, by the way, for the student loans and for the personal loans, not for the mortgages. Let's roll into our FinTech segment. For those of you new to the show, every Friday we like to bring you, as a little break in the middle of the show, a company that we've heard of that we think that you will enjoy hearing about. That's not an endorsement of any of the companies that we have on this segment, but certainly we love toys and I love showing you new stuff that's coming out. So here's what we got today. I met Cindy Zhu at FinCon, and it's cool. She actually came to our congratulations party that we hosted with SoFi after the FinTech competition, which SoFi also sponsored. Cindy's company, Caval, they won the FinTech competition at FinCon, and just another in a line of some fantastic companies we got to talk to there. But let's hear why they won. Let's hear what's so cool about Caval and how they're going to help you make better investment picks. Say hello to Cindy coming down to the basement. And Cindy Zhu from Kavout.com joins me. Welcome to the party.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fantastic now that you're here in the basement with us. So I'm glad on your world tour telling people about Kavout that you could stop by.
Thank you. And it was good to meet you down in San Diego at FinCon. That was great. It was my first time.
Well, congratulations on the big win. I have to ask this. Were you surprised when on the main stage, our friends from SoFi and the judges said that you had won?
I was surprised, honestly, because we were up against some really, really tough competition. And I watched a lot of their pitches and some of them blew me out of the water. It was really good. So I think that overall the competition was great, and the entire conference was great. Just the amount and the caliber of the speakers that were there and all the panels. It was nothing that I've ever been to before, for sure.
Well, how did Kvout come about? Was it because maybe you were frustrated about something, you know, in your personal life, or did it come about because you and maybe somebody else saw an opening? Tell me about the genesis of Kvout.
Our CEO, Alex Liu, I'm going to tell you a little bit about him because I think that kind of speaks to the story. Before he started Kvout, he served as the CTO of Dajihui, which is one of China's largest financial information providers. And his resume is just super techy. He was at Baidu. He was at Microsoft, at Google, early Google. He has an MBA from Columbia Business School and Tsinghua University in computer science. So he comes from a very tech background. And then when he joined that financial information provider company, he realized that the technology there just wasn't up to par. He wanted to build something that would advance kind of the entire financial services industry. The problem was this entire landscape was evolving. And on Wall Street, a lot of these large hedge funds and investment banks, they're hiring top talent in artificial intelligence and machine learning. For instance, Bridgewater Associates, they just started a new AI unit led by the person who developed IBM's Watson. Goldman Sachs is more engineers than Facebook. None of these things are a coincidence because these big players know that investing in AI and machine learning is what's going to give them an edge in the markets. So Alex created Kvout because he wanted to bring AI and machine learning to the everyday investor and to level the playing fields because he believed that everyone deserved to have the same tools that the pros use on Wall Street.
What does machine learning mean? Because I'm sure there's a percentage of our audience, Cindy, driving down the road going, I've heard that term before, but I really don't know what that means.
Machine learning is kind of a subset of artificial intelligence, and it's what provides computers the ability to learn without explicitly being told and being programmed to do so. So the computer will know what to learn and when to learn, and that they can teach themselves to grow and adapt and change to whatever landscape they're in. So that's what machine learning is.
Got it. So Kvout's going to become the movie Terminator.
Yeah, we're creating an investment Terminator. Someone said that at the conference. I was like, okay, yeah, you can put it that way, I guess.
Yeah, you're backing up that truck pretty quickly, though. Yeah, so how exactly does it work then? What happens?
What we did was we built a machine called Kai. And Kai is the core artificial intelligence and machine learning system that powers Kvout. And Kai is examining millions and millions of data points every second. It's looking at all aspects of a stock. It's looking at many, many variables in order to find correlations that would otherwise not be visible to a human stock analyst or just a human analyst in general. And from Kai, we've built an entire investment platform around Kai, and you can actually access that for free right now on www.kvout.com. And on this platform, the way I describe it is a Google Finance, Yahoo Finance on steroids. You can do research on stocks and uncover, you know, new investment opportunities on this platform. But what's unique about the platform is that we've integrated Kai pretty simply into it because Kai is rating every stock in the universe from a scale of 1 to 9. So a high Kai score, so a 9, means that the stock is going to have a greater probability of outperforming. And a low Kai score means that Kai thinks it's probably not going to do so well in the future. And you'll be able to go on and type in a stock and you'll be able to see what Kai thinks. You'll be able to see all the fundamental data, all the technical data, really great charting. And if you really are into 10Ks and reading all of the reports, we've put them all there in a really beautiful fashion. Some people are into it. I commend them, but I'm definitely not one.
I was going to say, I can't include myself unless I'm trying to get to sleep. Then maybe Kai can help me go to sleep.
I mean, Warren Buffett apparently reads 10Ks as like bedtime reading. So good for him.
Can you tell me any of the pieces that are a part of Kai? I mean, I know that it is probably proprietary technology, but what kind of goes into it?
Okay, that's a good question. In machine learning, a variable is kind of called a feature. So there's over 200 features that is trying to simulate this neural net to calculate all these Kai scores. And an example of like a simple feature obviously would be, you know, the sales of a company or the net income or the EBITDA. But then you could go one step further and you could look at, you know, the scores that we all know, the Z scores, the F scores, the M scores. And then going even further, we could look at ratios, right? So that's a little more complicated. Capital to long-term debt, return on equity. And then that last step that we've also included is like the time series of all of these features. So like a 3-year trailing, you know, EBITDA or like something like over time. So it's a little more complicated than just like a flat net income. So those are some examples of the features. And then Kai is looking at a stock from the quality, value, growth, and momentum perspective. So okay. In terms of quality, when you think of like a good quality stock, well, you can look at, you know, working capital to long-term debt. You can look at dividend payout. For value, you would look at earnings yield or enterprise value to EBITDA, right? And then so under each of these, we've also programmed different, you know, historic indicators into Kai. So Kai is just looking at all of these continuously every single second, and it's just analyzing and interpreting millions of parameters every day.
I see how you've got a bunch of different screens in there, which talks to, you know, going after value, going after growth, going after different things. I'm on a page right now where it's talking about Peter Lynch screen, Warren Buffett screen, Benjamin Graham screen. What are those all about?
Yes, we've taken the most common, well, not common, but like most like famous gurus, investors, and we've torn down, you know, their entire strategy, and we've quantified their strategies into mathematical, you know, quantifiable formulas in which we've applied to our screener. And I think that our screener is one of the best on the market because it's really robust. It's really easy to use. So you go and you can click on like any one of these screens and it'll look at the market through the eyes of a Warren Buffett or Benjamin Graham or Peter Lynch. And you can kind of see like on the side exactly which one, which filters we used and like how it's ranked by. And we've created portfolios based on those. So it's kind of like an easy way to try a new strategy in case you wanted to find a new strategy, basically.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you can also do your own too. You can create your own screen. If you're a really value person, you can screen it based on what Kai thinks, based on Kai score. You can screen it based on, you know, a company's fundamentals. We want to like really enable the investor to do what they want.
It sounds, Cindy, like a place I would get lost in the weeds, though. I mean, but because I love this stuff, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. I mean, I don't enjoy reading 10Ks, but if you give me a toy and tell me that I can look at a stock 50 different ways, I will totally be there all day looking at stocks 50 different ways.
And that's important because I think, I mean, especially for me, I'm a pretty fundamental person. I come from banking, so I'm not really like that sentiment driven. So I want to spend the time to look for the right stock and to really see like, okay, are all the indicators that I care about there? And it's good. Everyone's different. It's not like people are like, oh, is this going to, if I just give money to Kai, will it make me money? It's like, well, no, that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to empower you with tools because you're still ultimately the last decision maker. You're the one who's going to pull that trigger and, you know, put whatever money into it. So we just want to empower the investor with the best technology and the best information out there and just get it to them.
Yeah, this really narrows the gap, like you were saying, mm-hmm. between the institutional investor and Joe Main Street. What do I do then? So I go to Kvout.com. I then, there's a big yellow box that says create a new account. Click on that. I create my account. You said that's free right now.
Mm-hmm. It's super easy. It's free. You just need an email and a password.
Okay. Then Cindy, how do you guys make money?
Right now, we're still a very technology-driven company. And the core of our technology is this Kai technology, right? This machine learning like model that we've made. So right now, we are actually going to launch the first free trading app into China that'll also be powered by Kai. So that's an exciting thing. That's going to be happening in a few months. Yeah. And then also we're working with like the smaller, you know, wealth management or the RIAs or just data vendors or hedge funds who want this data. Like they're curious about this Kai data because they're like, okay, it's like an alternative type of data and it could act as like a leading indicator for them. So we've been approached by a lot of these institutions just for the data alone. And I mean, that's like up to interpretation too, you know, and for us, it's worked because we've tested it. And our most recent test was from a period of 2012 to 2016. And we put all the Kai scores of 9 into a portfolio.
Okay.
We put all the Kai scores of 1 into another portfolio. And then we kind of let it just go and see whether or not Kai was right. So in this control simulation, Kai chose stocks that beat the S&P by more than 5% annually, and it chose underperforming stocks that lagged the market by about also 5%.
Holy cow.
And yeah, Kai crushed it. And we're very pumped about that. So we haven't actually officially released a statement talking about it, because that's going to open a whole nother door of whole nother jar of monkeys, as I like to say. But we'll definitely be announcing that soon. And it's exciting to have a technology, but it's also a little bit scary.
Yes. Well, so back to how you guys get paid, though. So you said hedge funds and some of the RIAs are paying you for the data. Is there ever a time if I go sign up now that I'll have to pay for that in the future?
We're thinking about creating like a premium service in addition to the platform that you see right now.
Okay.
So some of the future things that we're coming out with is going to be like a chart pattern recognition algorithm that's going to be powered by Kai. So we're currently trying to teach Kai how to see certain chart patterns. And there's a lot of traders who trade on chart patterns, but to be able to recognize these patterns and automatically like trigger a trade. So that's what we're looking at. And that's like pretty cool technology. I don't think there's many companies or firms that have been able to achieve that. And then also kind of like a good sentiment indicator, because there are people who do trade on sentiment, but not all the sentiment out there is good data. Because, you know, you could like buy a million Twitter followers to tweet something and then suddenly like a stock pumped up, right? So we are, you know, using Kai for, you know, textual sentiment and natural language processing of blogs, of social media, of like all things online. So we're trying to train them to do that. So those are some premium features that we'd offer in the future. And probably we would charge kind of like a for like a premium account, maybe.
I like the idea. Actually, I just clicked on your upcoming features page. And I like the idea of stock trading, where I can go right from the Kavao website into my brokerage account, make a trade. Do you see that coming anytime soon?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're actually actively working to find a good partner for that here. Ideally, we'd have, you know, many options for people to log into Kavao and then directly be able to trade into the brokerage account. So that's definitely something that's coming up in the future.
Well, I thought training my cat to do anything was hard. I can't imagine machine learning and teaching Kai to do all the stuff you're talking about, Cindy. So the website is kavao.com, and we'll have links, everybody, to Kavao in our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Thanks for hanging out, Cindy.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have more from Cindy and Kavao on our show notes at stackybenjamins.com, or it's kavout.com. It's K-A-V-O-U-T. All right, enough of this. Let's head back to this fun discussion with David Stein from Money for the Rest of Us, the retirement answer man, Roger Whitney, and of course, our frequent guest, Katie Brewer from Your Richest Life Planning. Let's just go to our third article, which is at Bloomberg.com. This is a great article about behavioral finance, guys. Can science make people save money? We all know how bad the savings rate is in America and, frankly, in lots of places around the world. This is by Rebecca Greenfield. She talks about an experimental program at a New York check cashing company, which tried to incentivize savings accounts for the poor. She says, but the psychology of poverty is hard to overcome. It's amazing, Roger. We'll start with you. This place, Right Check, will cash your check and they don't have any fees and they try to get people to do the right thing. Do you think that we need more of that?
No, I thought this was a crazy article.
Why?
Okay, we're going to try to get poor people to save money. Well, if they're poor, and the reason people use these check cashing places is because they need their cash right away because they have bills to pay. The idea that having poor people save is what's going to save them or bring them out of poverty, I think, is really silly. Really, what they need is a hand up in terms of creating the skills and having the opportunities to get themselves out of being poor. When you're poor, you don't have time to save because you're just trying to keep the lights on.
So you're saying it's an income problem?
I think it's an income problem. If you're poor and you're using a check cashing place, you know, trying to get someone to save is sort of silly.
But the reason, David, people don't, and we've had people on that are experts in this area before, the reason that they go to these check cashing places initially where they pay these exorbitant fees is not because of the fact that they can't save. A lot of experts think it's because they don't trust the system because the banks have screwed them so many times, right? Banks give phenomenal discounts to people who are wealthy, and they do that on the backs of poor people who continually pay overdraft fees and pay fees because they rearrange the way that transactions come in on a day to make sure that it's more fees, ATM fees, things like that. You think this type of program would work?
Well, I think what came out very clear in the article is that the users of these check cashing stores were very, very skeptical. Really, there's no catch to the savings account. I mean, just they don't trust the system.
Yeah.
And one of the issues is it talked about if you put money in a bank, in a savings account, the federal government can garnish your wages. They can take that money if you owe back taxes or a lien or something. And so having the cash under the mattress, people are more comfortable. And I agree with Roger. I think it's an income problem. I mean, and it's an education problem. It really is. But it mentioned, you know, they'll put 40 in one week, take out 10 the next week. And even the workers at these cash checking places, they probably are in as much trouble. In other words, they're not. I suspect the workers aren't big savers either. So it's hard to encourage or model behavior when you're not doing it yourself.
You know, I think that a lot of people think it's just an education problem when it's been proven over and over that these people just don't trust the system. I mean, they understand how the system works, and they would much rather pay the $40 fee to have their check cashed immediately than be just beaten over the head over and over and over by some bank account that robs them blind over time.
Well, and perhaps what it'll be, the change agent will be with some other type. Maybe it'll be an app or, you know, all the fintech things that are coming out where saving isn't necessarily associated with a financial institution. And I don't know what the answer is, but I think it is a combination of education, income, and overcoming some of the negative perception of financial institutions.
Katie, do you think...
And the reality is, you know, what benefit was there of putting money in a savings account that basically maybe earned 0.02%? What was the benefit of that over a mattress?
In terms of income?
Yeah.
Not much. No, good point. Yeah, good point. Katie, do you think that science can make people save money?
You know, in this particular article, the experiment didn't really work all that well. They kind of, you know, in this experiment, they didn't have that many people that put into savings accounts when it was easy for them to do it. But I think there are other things where they've made it easier to save. So the whole like keep the change thing that started so long ago, I mean, people thought that was amazing. It was all psychological. You know, you can keep the change by doing automatic withdrawals out of your account and having it go to savings. But for some weird reason, when it was like, oh, we just round up and we put your change back in your savings account, people got excited about it because they didn't have to do anything.
Roger, it's funny. I didn't mean to poo-poo your point there at the start that it's an income problem, because obviously near the end of the article, it talks about that, that I love this big, big box quote on the article. I don't think we affluent researchers fully appreciate the financial pressures on low-income family. Do you think that what we were talking about earlier with apps, maybe that's a solution to help us save more money?
Well, first off, I don't appreciate you poo-pooing on me.
I got to use my mom phrase once every show.
That's your mom phrase is poo-pooing?
Yeah, my mom says poo-pooing all the time. Don't poo-poo that, Joe. I'm sorry, Mom.
I do think apps are a great idea, and I do think there is a lot of FinCon things that can help people save. I mean, even just the automatic enrollment in 401ks, and that's how I learned to save, was just automatic things that happen. But some of the things we talked about with community banks and credit unions, that may be the route for people that are worried about the system. I think from a fintech perspective, in terms of encouraging savings and the psychology of it, the problem is we have a nuclear arsenal of fintech in advertising and 24/7 television that encourages us to save. So it's almost like spinning in the wind trying to fight that avalanche of scientifically designed messages trying to get us to spend our money.
David, how did you first learn how to save money?
Back in the old days, went to a credit union and I put my $5 in, and I had the little booklet where they would type in how much money you had. And so you would see this column of numbers go bigger and bigger. And I remember thinking, you know, I had $25. I was pretty rich and really wanted to be rich like my friend that had over $100. But you did it by going, and at that time, just you go to a financial institution. But ultimately, you realize that savings is the way you get freedom. And that's been the driver for me to save over the years, is because I value freedom and am willing to give up things now so that I can have freedom to pursue the life I want to live.
You talk a little bit, though, when you talked about your friend, about it makes me believe it's a little bit about your community, right? The people you're around, you see people around, that kid's saving $100. I got five. I want to get to where he's at. Was it also your family? Were your parents the one that gave you the nudge to go down and open up that account?
Yeah, they probably took me down. I mean, I don't remember, you know, in my growing up years, it was a lack of savings and a lack of money that was the motivating force in my life. So, you know, yes, they took me to the credit union, but beyond that, it was sort of negative examples, or I don't want to live like this when I grow up if I can avoid it.
That's fun. That's what Greg McFarlane always says, because in his family, it was that negative example and he wanted to get away from that also. Katie, what was your first savings? How did you first learn?
I think my family and community were actually pretty instrumental in encouraging, you know, okay, will you get an allowance? And how are you going to handle that? You know, and if I would say, oh, I'm going to go blow it all immediately on bubblegum, you know, they'd be like, wrong answer. Try again. And I'd be like, I'm going to go blow half of it on bubblegum. And they'd be like, yes, that is the correct answer. So, I mean, part of what this article was addressing was two different things. Like, one of them is automating savings.
Yeah.
And then one of them is poverty and breaking the poverty cycle. And I think those two things are big issues to tackle. And I'm not sure if automating stuff is going to break a poverty cycle.
No, but I think what we're talking about here with David, it was community partly. With you, it's community. I think that part of the poverty cycle also is when you're impoverished, you're also in this poverty mindset. And everyone around you has the poverty mindset, which I think, you know, it's not about mindset. I think that's a first world way of answering the question, right? It's not just mindset. There's some real problems there, but I think it magnifies the problem, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And what's interesting is I get people reaching out quite a bit to me who have, they kind of self-identify that they grew up poor or that they grew up in poverty, and they might be the first one in their family to go to college and actually get a decent job. And it's really interesting talking to these people, because not only are they battling kind of the poverty mindset, like as soon as I have it, I want to get rid of it, you know, or as soon as I have it, I want to make sure that I use it to its full extent, which is spending it. But, you know, they also have family members that kind of depend on them because they're the only one that actually got to college and got a decent working job. And so now they've got like parents that rely on them and sometimes siblings. So it's always kind of interesting having conversations with people and seeing that side of it.
Roger, what about you? When did you first learn to save?
You know, it's interesting. I want to hit on one point real quick. We're talking about, you know, the people in poverty using these things. In my practice as a financial planner, I see a lot of poor people that you would never recognize. They happen to have big incomes right now, but they're pretty poor. They don't have a dime.
Yeah, right. Right.
And they're no different. They're no different than someone that uses a check cashing place. They just happen to have a bigger income right now, but they still have the same problem of meeting bills. And I would count myself as not a natural saver. I like things. I like my Apple stuff, and I'm not frugal by nature. And it's been the automatic thing. So when I was growing up, my parents never talked about money. And it was, I think it was getting my first job and signing up for the 401k just so I could have it happen automatically. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And then you just sort of learned it from there. But I've always had a discipline problem. So I've always tried to put these automatic things in place rather than rely on my self-discipline.
Well, that's using science in your favor, isn't it? Because I think most of us have a discipline problem.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
Not me. I just actually take all the money out of the bank and I stick it right in front of me just to see if I cannot spend it every week.
I was surprised to hear that David had a savings problem, because I thought he was so frugal that when he went in the delivery room, he saw a penny on the floor and picked it up.
Is that me? Who are
you talking? You know, when you throw a jab at somebody and they
No.
David's like,
I think everyone has a savings problem. What usually helps people overcome it is you increase your income and you learn to just keep the same lifestyle as your income grows, and suddenly you find you have savings.
Get out of the rat race, you're saying.
Well, yeah, you just don't try to keep increasing your lifestyle. Get to a comfortable lifestyle. I call it live like you're rich without the money. And then as the money comes in, you're not always trying to increase your lifestyle. You try to find a base level of happiness with a fairly, not necessarily frugal lifestyle. I mean, you can still have Apple products and stuff, but you can drive. I drive a 15-year-old car that can, you know, it's a fast car. I love driving. It's fun. But it's 15 years old, but it's as fun to drive as a brand new car, and it saves me a boatload of money not going out and leasing a brand new car. But I get just as much satisfaction as I would a brand new car.
I think we'll leave it right there. I thought it's an interesting discussion. Obviously, a lot of stuff we talked about today, I don't think we're going to solve. We're clearly, I don't think big banks are going away anytime soon, and I certainly think they're going to continue to at least hold on to market share. I don't know what we do about corporate activism. I'm not sure how we solve some of those big problems on Wall Street, but I love the discussion we had there. And then science making people save money. Man, poverty, obviously, been around since the beginning of time, and it's a difficult cycle for people to break out of. Let's talk about what's going on at your place as a business. Katie, we'll start with you. Thanks for being on the show again.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. You know, I didn't bomb this too bad, so that's good.
Fantastic, as usual. That's why we love having you on the show. So what's going on at Your Richest Life Planning?
Yeah, I just put out an article on the blog, so it's yrlplanning.com, or if you want to type it all out, it's yourrichestlifeplanning.com/blog. Just put one out on charitable giving and kind of how to work it into your life, budget, and estate plan. It's a topic that tends to come up quite a bit. I mean, whenever I talk to people about goals, they usually have some family-related goals, and then they have some charitable intentions, or they're already giving to charity, and that's a non-negotiable in their budget. So I thought it would be a good article to address.
It's also a topic, Katie, as you know, that comes up a lot this time of year, near the end of the year, right? As people are doing their tax planning.
Yeah, for some reason, people like to get tax deductions, too. It's
crazy.
So weird.
Roger, how about at the Retirement Answer Man podcast? Thanks for coming on again, by the way.
Always, buddy. Always. One of the most exciting things, I've had the best interview I've had. I recently read a book called The 100-Year Life. Highly recommend it. And I had the author, Andrew Scott, who is a economist at the London School and taught at Harvard. And it's one of the most impactful interviews talking about, even if you're a baby boomer, what longevity is going to do to retirement and how you need to rethink how you plan your life out. Love it. So it's all at rogerwhitney.com.
I love that piece of this job, don't you? Where you read a book that you love, and this is one of the few jobs where you're like, let's see if I can talk to the author.
Exactly.
And because you're a podcaster, you know, more often than not, they're very happy to come talk to you.
Yeah. And Hook, and I mean, he and his co-author are both professors at the London School in London. And we just get on Skype and have a conversation, and the impact that it has on the audience and being able to get this kind of information, it's really incredible.
And David, thanks a ton for coming back and helping us save this podcast.
That was fun. Thanks for having me. Yeah, my show, we just recently released episode 129, and it was based on a listener that had watched the movie The Big Short and came away very discouraged, as the characters in that movie who were real life characters are making money off of people's hardships. And he wanted to know, is investing an immoral activity? So we addressed that on that episode. And we also answered the question about Dave Ramsey mentioned you could become a millionaire saving $35 a week, but there were no footnotes in his charts as to how to do that. So we broke that down to see how much you would have to earn on your investing to get to $1 million and $35 a week in savings.
Was it just you don't retire until you're 101?
Oh, no, it was in 40 years. In 40 years.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and do you get the, what's the number he quoted? You get 12% per year?
He didn't. That was the point. There was no number. And LaPrelle had, my wife was reading it to me in the car, and it's like, well, great. You know, what's the footnote say? And in the footnote, there's absolutely no context in terms of what the annual rate of return was to get. And it turns out it's upwards of 12%.
When you're not regulated, you can say anything.
Exactly.
That's what we do here, you know.
I'm joking. General education.
And that's right. And that's no gambling on the show either. No betting on which way we're going to go with any of these topics. And by the way, David, you mentioned the show. Again, of course, it's Money for the Rest of Us, and you can get it wherever finer podcasts are sold, right?
That's right. Or you can go right to the website at moneyfortherestofus.net.
Awesome. And if people are driving down the road or you're out taking your walk, you'll find everybody's, Katie's, Roger's, and David's stuff, to use the technical term, at our show notes at stackybenjamins.com. Thanks for playing, guys.
Awesome. Thank you, man.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks.
Oh, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. Hey, you know what? I've been saying for the past couple weeks that we have a new game started, and guess what? I've been traveling again, and I still don't have a game for us. So that means that the game is coming, but not yet. In fact, you know what? I'm looking at the calendar, and I don't think we're going to have a, Friday game in the next few weeks because of the fact that it's going to get choppy. November is fine, but of course we have the holiday crunch in the United States around Thanksgiving. A week after that, we have our regular off week after 8 weeks of programming. And then 2 weeks after that, we're into the end of the year week, which we always take off. We didn't used to take off, but when you look at the listener numbers, you can see why we play past episodes, because when we were making new episodes, nobody listened because we're all doing other stuff. So for those people that need some more Stacky Benjamins, we'll play some of our favorites. We'll have Griffin the intern take care of that for us. So anyway, it's going to be so choppy. Us having a game here, I've realized, is not going to work. So game's coming back at the beginning of the year. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We still got a lot of 2016 left, don't we? So let's talk about what's coming up on the Stacking Benjamin show next week. This is going to be great. There is a website that originally started off just a guy talking about his family adventure. Jeremy from the awesome place Go Curry Cracker. He and his spouse, Winnie, have decided, you know what? The usual lifestyle is not for them. So they decided to live all over the world. In fact, they spend very little money. They save a ton of money, and they travel the world. They're all over the place. So Jeremy is going to tell us about that. It's funny because on their about page, it tells everything that you need to know. It says, go to school, get good grades, get a good job, buy a house, work for 30 plus years, be a good consumer, retire on a golf course. He says, for many, these are the ingredients for success, but life has more to offer those willing to change the recipe. So they have done phenomenal things at Go Curry Cracker. We're going to talk to Jeremy specifically about his feeling on taxes, because I think he'll be eye-opening for a lot of people, and you're going to love what we have from him. Another guy I've wanted to meet for a long time, and I finally got to meet him at FinCon this year. Didn't even know who he was. Kathleen, our business partner, has the way of asking people to go to lunch that we don't know, which is great, because I generally don't get out of my shell and do that. We are passing a couple people, and they're both going to be on the show. Jeremy from Go Curry Cracker and Gwen is going to be on the show later, and we'll tell you more about her later, because that's going to be a hilarious episode. Then on Wednesday, if you watch the CW on the weekends, you know there is a new program out called Hatched. It's kind of like Shark Tank, except they're really less intimidating and more working with the entrepreneur. So if you kind of take Shark Tank and you spray on the profit and you add some other pieces to it, you find Hatch. And Hatch is a phenomenal show. And we have executive producer and one of the I almost called him one of the sharks, but you know what I'm talking about. One of the judges on the show, Steve Seagal, is joining us. He's on that show, by the way. Nicole Lappin, who's been on this podcast before, media personality. Nicole's also on the show, and it's great. Steve and Nicole doing this great show together. And I'm glad that we could talk about what makes a great investment. Now that people can crowdfund, right? We can get on these crowdfunding investment choices. What makes a great investment to invest in? And when people, for entrepreneurs out there, we're also going to talk about when he's talking to these entrepreneurs, what is it that disqualifies people? Because it's usually the same crap, isn't it? It always seems to be like three or four things. And then, of course, on Friday next week, we'll have another phenomenal roundtable. And our friends from DIY, they also had one of the hits at FinCon, at the FinTech competition. And I can't wait for you to hear more about that. So action-packed week next week. Lots of great stuff. Traveling around the world, paying less money in taxes, entrepreneurship, do-it-yourself savings. Oh, my goodness. It's almost too much to handle. tomorrow, remember, over on the Green Room, we have vintage episodes. Show producer Richie and I will kick that off tomorrow. That's a separate feed. Listen to the Green Room on Saturdays. That's what we do. We take you through every episode from start to finish. And on Tuesdays, we give you behind the scenes stuff from the show. And also on Saturdays, we give you a little behind the scenes. But all right, that's it. Have a great weekend. Catch us on the Green Room tomorrow. Go stack some Benjamins. Bye-bye.
Special thanks to Cindy Zhu from CavOut. Find out more information on their website, cavout.com. That's K-A-V-O-U-T.com. Or follow the link in our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. Special thanks to David Stein for Money for the Rest of Us. You'll find David's show wherever you listen to podcasts, as you will for the Retirement Answer Man podcast. Special thanks to Roger Whitney, the Retirement Answer Man himself, for stopping by the show today. And also special thanks to Katie Brewer from Your Richest Life Planning. You'll find links to Katie's blog and all of the podcasts listed here at our show notes at stackingbenjamins.com. This show is the property of SB Podcasts, LLC. The show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Richie Rutter-Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remuneration. There's no way you would take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial moves, consult with a real financial advisor. And special thanks to Joe's mom for saying that she's going to keep the Halloween candy bowl around for a few more days. If it weren't for this huge sugar high I'm on right now, I don't think I'd ever make it through these podcasts.
What was that?
It's called the medium sketch.
The medium sketch?
Yeah, it wasn't rare, and it certainly wasn't well done.